This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
And this is Drew Tignanelli here with Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here with Christopher John O'Shea. Christopher?
Andrew, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, and you?
I'm doing great, thank you.
Last week was an open show, so this week we're doing a guest.
That's how we roll.
That's how we roll. No calls tonight, Bethany, and we're missing Anita. I guess she's on vacation. All right, I'll have to give her a hard time about that next week. But
don't miss an opportunity.
Don't miss an opportunity. Right, so tell everyone who our guest is tonight and little facts about them.
Will do. Will do. We are interviewing James Besson about his book, Learn by Doing, The Real Connection Between Innovation, Wages, and Wealth. He's a lecturer at Boston University Law School, a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. Before joining the Academy, he was the founder of Best Info, a pioneering desktop publishing software company. His research on software patents with Eric Maskin and Robert Hunt has been influential in both the U.S. and Europe. And then he's appeared in many publications on NPR, national and regional programming, including the Planet Money and the Takeaway programs, along with Forum with Michael Krasny. He has written or been interviewed by New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post,
Money, Riches, and Wealth.
And now we can add that, Money, Riches, and Wealth. And I was talking to him about, he resides in Portland, Maine. So we were talking about that earlier today. So he says they're in a heat wave up there today. It might crack 80 degrees.
That's great, you know. I love Maine at this time of year. It's got to be one of the most beautiful places to be. James, how are you?
I'm good. It actually hit 81 today.
All right. Well, I think we hit 89 today, so that's actually been pretty cool here in Baltimore also. Hey, James, I'm going to hit you with probably the toughest question I'm going to ask you all night, and your book is called Learning by Doing. And so the question I have for you is, I'm reading your book, and you're talking about learning by doing, and, you know, it's not rocket science. Everybody knows that a doctor becomes a doctor not by going to medical school, but by practicing medicine, and a lawyer doesn't become a lawyer by going to law school, but by practicing law, and, you know, and a person, you know, doesn't become an auto mechanic by reading books. He does it by working on cars. So I know how I would answer the question after finishing your book, but why don't you tell our listeners why your book? Why did you do this, Learning by Doing? What's your new insight here?
So the insight is about technology. Everybody knows that learning through experience is important at one level, but when we start thinking about technology, we don't realize how important technology is for learning from experience and how learning from experience is important for being able to implement technologies. We tend to think of technologies being, as one person put it, machines that are designed by geniuses to be run by idiots. and in reality, it's nothing like that. Very rarely do we see new technologies come out where it takes an idiot. We tend to think often of people as being unskilled who may work in a factory or whatever, but if you look at the history, it's just not true. The early textile mills, for instance, went to great lengths to recruit the best and most talented people to run the spinning and weaving machines.
Yeah. So that's your concept, and and what you're talking about is a lot of people think that technology is here to just merely displace workers, and you're ultimately saying is that's not really what's happening.
Right. And there's two issues. One is there's this misconception that technology eliminates jobs. Technology does come along and it takes over certain tasks we do, but at the same time, it increases demand. It makes things cheaper, it makes new products, it makes things better, better services, and because it increases demand, it very often in the early stages, it actually increases employment. So so we see that we saw that in the Industrial Revolution. In the 19th century, machines basically took over 98% of the labor involved in weaving cotton cloth. It took 100 years for technology to move to do that. But during that time, the number of weavers actually increased. And it increased because cotton cloth got a whole lot cheaper, and so people bought lots more of it. At the beginning of the 19th century, people had remarkably few clothes and remarkably few home furnishings made with cloth.
Yeah, because if you need 5 or 10 people to make one shirt, it's got to cost a whole bunch of money. If you have one machine that one loomer makes 100 shirts, it got a lot cheaper and people bought a lot more.
And the same thing is happening with computer technology today, or a very similar thing. It turns out that overall, if you look at occupations that have been computerized, jobs increase. So people will tell you stories, for instance, that, oh, the automated teller machine came along and we got rid of bank tellers. And actually what happened is we have more bank tellers today than in 2000 when they were sort of in the midst of installing the ATM machines.
So your mill girls, well, we're almost at that first traffic break, but when we come back, okay, what I wanted to hear about is, so these loomers come in with this high technology in those days, 1800s, they come in with this high technology, these power loomers, but they're hiring these young ladies who are literate. And there was a purpose as to why they did that and how that increased the productivity, immensely. But anyway, I got to take that first traffic break, James. But when we come back, you're going to tell us more about that story and why it's important. So take it away, traffic. We'll be right back. Money, Riches, and Wealth.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
So we're back, Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're with James Besson. He wrote the book Learning by Doing. And as I've stated many times on this show, I believe education in this country is the greatest crisis we're going through and that we have for the future of our country. And that, you know, it's people like James and others that we've interviewed that we think can make a big difference in how this country can succeed in the future if we don't get our education, if we start to work on getting our education process in a better place.
And he's going to answer your question right now, but to presage another one, hinging off what you just said, he takes Peter Drucker to task on his interpretation of what that education means.
Yeah.
What type of education?
Yeah. So let's start with the mill workers. So why? They got these super machines that can do almost everything. Why are they hiring literate young ladies, which probably wasn't easy to find back in the early 1800s?
The population of the U.S. was advanced in its degree of literacy, but still they went to great efforts, and they did lots of other things. They offered courses. They offered the ability. The mill girls put out numbers of publications. They studied various things. One of the mill girls later became a college teacher, referred to her years in the mills as being very much like college.
Huh.
And the reason was, so here is this new technology, and nobody quite knows how to use it in the most efficient way. Nobody knows how to organize production. You're taking farm girls from rural New England who've never seen anything like it. It's a noisy environment, just packed full of mechanical devices. It's, you know, this strange new thing. And their ability to learn how to be efficient with it was critical for the economic success of the entire enterprise. They learned on the job, and you can actually see, you know, you can look back in the historical records and see their month-by-month progress. After 6 months, they were much, much more productive than they were in their first month or two. And this was critical for the success. Those mills that failed to recruit and train their workers well failed. Those that did well succeeded and were wildly profitable.
Wow. So, as Chris, I'm saying that education is extremely important, and businesses, I believe, have a obligation to continue to develop their workers. And now Chris is saying that, you know, you're bringing Peter Drucker. Now, it's not an easy task to do, bring Peter Drucker to task on something and say, you know, he's right, but, you know, I want to do it. I think it ought to be done with a twist from what Peter was saying. So tell us about that.
Well, so Peter Drucker talked about the knowledge economy, and he thought about it as being in professional terms, that, you know, all of the new jobs, people were knowledge workers, and they had to be in professions. I disagree with that in a way, because unfortunately in this country, professionalism and occupational licensing have become often a barrier to knowledge rather than a means of enhancing it. Surprisingly, today, about a third of the workforce is required to get some sort of occupational license to practice their occupation. Very often, the restrictions that these regulatory bodies impose have little to do with consumer benefits or safety. Sometimes those benefits are very important, but it's really gotten out of hand, so very often they don't, and you have licensing requirements for all sorts of people, not only doctors and that sort of professional, but hair braiders or people making tombstones. They become obstacles to allowing people to learn on their own and develop the skills they need.
I saw you talking about that the licensing and professional requirements are trade barriers more often than they are consumer protections. So what areas do you think that government should be requiring professionalization or certification of some sort, and what areas do you not? How do you balance that between a doctor and a financial advisor, let's say, and a hair braider?
Yeah, so first off, I think there's an important difference between a professional license and a certification. The certification essentially lets the consumer decide. You know, I can get, if I want to get plastic surgery, I can go to a board-certified plastic surgeon. That's somebody who's been certified to have those skills. They've passed the test. They've proven to other doctors in that category that they're able to do it. There are a lot of people doing plastic surgery that are not board certified, and I can choose to go to them or not. The thing is, it's not keeping someone from developing skills. Where I think particularly as you go down the occupational ladder where the consequences are just much less severe, number one, the occupational licensing makes very little sense, if any. Do we really need to be protected from unscrupulous barbers or hair braiders? Not clear. There's not much at stake there. But there's also, I think, what's happened in a lot of states is that licensing boards are set up by the professions themselves. They've been granted really state powers by the state, and without oversight from consumer interests or the interests of the public at large, and I think that's perhaps one of the bigger issues, that where the occupational restrictions tend to go overboard is in those states where the boards essentially have too much power without oversight.
So let me ask you this question. This is sort of I don't think you talked about this in your book. Well, actually you did indirectly, and it's, so you've got these workers who are sort of unskilled, but then they come in, they start learning this technology, and they become skilled in that regard. So here's the question is, where does unionization in your mind come into play, if at all? You talk about the mill worker girls trying to unionize, but were unsuccessful at doing it. So where is unionization? My point is that government has given unions too much power, but I believe wholeheartedly where workers should be able to, use their power collectively. But so give us your take on that.
Well, I can look at some of the history, and I think worker skills and unionization historically were very closely tied, and it cut both ways. So in many cases, unions ran the training programs.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I never knew that. I mean, you look at unions today and you wonder what the heck do they do, but I'm sorry.
Yeah,
that's a side comment.
Well, I think it's still true, for instance, in the construction unions.
Okay.
And on the other hand, a lot of the power that unions had stemmed from the fact that they had workers with highly specialized skills that could not easily be replaced. So, in those circumstances, the International Typographers Union was an extremely powerful union. It had, initially a 4 and then a 6-year apprenticeship that the union ran, and it ended up being terrifically powerful. It could shut down, I think in the early 60s, they had a newspaper strike in New York, and it basically they shut down the newspapers for months because it was very hard to replace their specialized skills. So, I'm not sure where I'm going with this, but I think I may have lost the thread. But there was always a close connection. I think unions can play a positive role in developing skills, and in other cases, and maybe not.
So, you're saying in your book, and I agree with this, and it's been tons of articles on this topic, that we don't have a scarcity of jobs in any way, shape, or form. We have a scarcity of skills. Jobs with skill requirements are out there abundant, but there aren't people that can easily fill them.
And very often these are specialized skills related to new technology, the problem is it's not people think it's about education. That people talk, there's no skills gap because we have plenty of college diplomas being turned out. It's not necessarily what you learn in school. It's because of the importance of learning by doing new tech. A lot of these new skills related to new technologies have to be learned on the job. It's very hard often for an employer to know who has the right skills, and it's very hard often for an employee to acquire the new skills. I have to have the right employer who's got the right technology. And there's a lot of, when technologies are uncertain and changing very rapidly, that's often very difficult.
So in the past, just getting a college education was what you needed to show to corporate America that you could come in and be a middle manager, and that worked great, but we're still educating under the same premise 50, 60 years later, and it's not working as well.
Yeah, I think it was always the case that the college diploma only got you in the door, and you still had to learn a lot on the job.
Yeah.
I think it's just you have much more to learn on the job, particularly technically related these days.
So hold on with us, James. We're going to take our next traffic pause, and then we're going to be right back. We're going into the second half of our show already. So take it away, traffic. We'll be right back. Money, riches, and wealth.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
And we're back with James Besson. We're talking about learning by doing, and talking about the adoption of new technology can take a long, long time. And one of the interesting parts of the book that I found, James, was your talk about the guy that created the Segway, and Steve Jobs says that whole cities are going to be built around Segways, and I don't know how many years it's been since he invented the Segway, but other than malls, I don't know anything else that's created around a Segway.
Well, I think I point out in the book also, they said very similar things about the automobile.
So I'm still waiting. One day I'm going to have to learn how to ride a Segway.
Yeah.
All right.
It took the automobile a long time, too, but we'll see.
So anyway, if I read it right, you're kind of like saying that the average student should not be going to college. He should be going to community college and learning technical skills instead of just general knowledge. Did I read that right? Or
No.
He's a professor at a university saying, no, don't say that.
I did have an interesting conversation with the university's PR person, but certainly a 4-year college is the right educational choice for many, many people. What I was saying was that I think our policy has overemphasized four-year colleges at the expense of community colleges. And community colleges, I think, can play a particularly important role at this time where we've got this whole new wave of technology that we need to deal with experience, because some of the best community colleges are working with local employers closely so that we see some, for instance, a lot of work-study programs where students spend part of the time in the classroom and part of the time at work, so that they get both the hands-on and the classroom knowledge that is so important in understanding how to deal with these new technologies.
So, you know, a lot of universities require you to do internships and so forth and so forth. You know, we take a lot of interns on at our company, but, you know, I have to be honest that, you know, some of my interns come on and, you know, all we can do is just give them some general things and, you know, a month or two later they're gone. And others come in and, you know, we realize that they're interested, they're excited, they want to learn, they, you know, and so forth. And we give them a lot more and, you know, the internship turns out. But there's nobody from the university is working with us to say, what can we do to inspire this person? And yeah. My point is there's a disconnect going on.
That may well be true. I think it is often very difficult. I mean, one of the things, you know, when you go to a classroom, you take a test. Classroom training, you know, has very clear measures, at least of some sort, about what you've learned, what you've digested. It's much harder with when you learn through experience. One, because you have to have the right personality, you have to have the right motivation, you have to be willing to experiment, you have to be willing to fail, and then get up and try again. And it's very hard to know when somebody has, it's often very hard to know when somebody has really acquired valuable experience as opposed to just time on the job. And so what you're pointing to is really a bigger problem, and it's a difficult problem.
So, you know, one of the biggest pounding of the tables you hear, and you're going to hear this throughout the presidential campaign coming up, is the wealth disparity, wealth disparity, wealth disparity. And Thomas Piketty, if I say his name correctly, is claiming that we should just go into everybody who's wealthy, take a whole bunch of money away from them and redistribute it. And you're saying, no, that's really not what we should be doing. Now, do I got that one right?
Well, I mean, whatever the merits of redistributing wealth are, I'm talking about something different. It's really about difference. We have a problem right now because we are not providing the opportunity that people need. First off, for the average person, we don't really care what the 1% is doing or the 0.1 or 0.01% is doing in terms of wealth. What we're seeing and that affects most people is that the median wage has hardly budged in the last 30 years.
But why do you think that is? So let's go to that. That's really, why do you think that is?
Well, I don't think there's a single answer, but I think one important part of it is the skills problem we're seeing. So what you're seeing in a whole range of occupations that are using new technology is a growing divide where you've got the top 10% or 20% are actually doing quite well, but the median worker isn't. The median worker has had those stagnant wages. And so why is this? If you look at it, it's very specifically about technology. You don't see this divide. You know, you see this divide in occupations that have been computerized, for instance, that are using computers heavily. And it's all about skills. There are new skills that have to be learned. Very often the schools can't teach them because they're changing too rapidly, they're too uncertain, they're not standardized. The best employees are able to, like I was talking a minute ago, you know, they're able to learn on their own. They're able to try things, to experiment, to fail, to keep at it, and to acquire knowledge of the very latest technologies and also of the different ways that we're using technology, the different business models and all of the complementary skills that go along with that.
So so years ago, it was pretty simple. You had to learn how to read, to write, and to add and multiply and so forth. And so
yeah,
that's what education...
Go
ahead.
Sorry, go on.
No, you go ahead. You got the point.
So, I mean, it was that would get you in the door, and you still had to learn some stuff, but... at that point, it was well understood, in most jobs, it was well understood what you had learned, and it was very clear to everyone involved when you had learned it. Here, we've got the technology changing very rapidly. So I use the example of the graphic designers, for instance. 30 years ago, graphic designers were all print designers, and many of them today still are. But first off, along came desktop publishing, which computerized them. Then along came the Internet, so they had to learn web design skills. And then along came the smartphone, and they had to learn mobile technology. And each time there are new standards, there are new tools to learn, new techniques, new ways of organizing work. It's constantly changing. And so what you see is the top 10 or 20% of designers are doing very well. The average designer isn't. So we're seeing this growing wage gap, and it's about skills. Very significantly.
We also have to teach our children how to accept change, because change is happening so rapidly. But in school, we don't teach children how to adopt to change. We try to teach them how to accept no change, in my opinion.
Right. Yeah. The graphic design schools just have a very hard time keeping up and keeping current, let alone those, you know, sort of those basic skills about it's about learning how to learn. The ideal school education will teach you that. Not everybody gets it, though.
So countries like Japan and Europe, though, are even in worse place than we are, because they are much more controlling in some ways. I mean, we're controlling in our own ways, but they're off the charts, in my opinion.
But I think in terms of the education systems, Japan or Korea have tended to have very rigid systems, and it doesn't lend itself well to.
But they also have a lot of big corporations and big governments and big unions that all work together as one team, and it's hard for an individual entrepreneur to break through that and say, I'm going to do something different.
Right. So that's why, for instance, I mean, Japan has large technology companies that excel in building computer hardware. They have fallen down in the software industry, though, for this very reason, that they don't encourage entrepreneurs and startups, so they have very little in the way of an independent software industry, and ultimately that's hurting their computer industry.
Yeah,
we're obviously doing certain things right, because as you say, 8 of the top of the 10 largest software companies are in America.
Right. And then everybody will tell you, well, software, you just need 3 guys in a garage, and that can happen anywhere in the world, and you can sell over the internet. But you have this very, you know, there's still this very strong geographic thing going on where there is a very definite U.S. advantage.
So you have to hold on with it, James. We're already coming to the last quarter hour of our show, and we're going to have to take our last traffic pause, and then we're going to be right back, and we're going to find out how we're going to solve this thing. You're going to have to solve it when we come back, James. All right. Take it away, Bethany.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
And we're back, Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're with James Besson. We're talking about his book, Learning by Doing. And, you know, James, in our company, we have a philosophy that all the employees, no matter who they are, and whether it's the main assistant or the young interns, and so forth, that they have to every year gain a new skill. In other words, go and do some kind of education. It doesn't have to be in the financial services industry. If they want to just learn cooking, we don't care. We just want them to tell us that by the end of the year, they went out and learned a new skill. And we want them to develop a new network that they can go into and meet other people and so forth, and just have a network. And so, here you are, you're coming in talking about learning by doing, and you're saying, You know, here's some of the, page 204. Here's some of the things I think we ought to do. So we are crowning you, James Bessin, czar of fixing our workers' problem of 2015. So what are you going to do, James?
Well, the first thing is I'll warn you that I don't think public policy can do it all.
Okay.
some of it.
But they can guide.
Yes, it can make a difference, but some of it, you know, is a matter that technology is changing very rapidly. We're in the early stages of many key technologies. Until things settle down, we're still.
But it's never going to settle down.
Yeah, I things go in phases, I think we see some areas. I can point to some areas in detail that to me say yes, some of the more mature industries. More mature technologies are settling down. I think particularly in healthcare, you're seeing a whole wave of technologies where we have, for all the ways that the healthcare industry is screwed up, in terms of worker skills and business models that work well with new technologies, some things are going right. But okay, let me answer. The question, I can point to several sort of big themes that I think are important.
Okay.
And so one is, I mentioned this earlier, we have to think about learning as being not just classroom learning. We need to think about ways that we can combine classroom learning with actual experience on the job, whether it's an apprenticeship-type program. Some companies are experimenting with that now, sort of the European model, German model. Or work-study programs, or other ways. What you're doing in terms of inviting employees to learn new skills—that's, you know, that's all part of the same thing. A second issue is standardization and certification. So, you know, one of the big problems with new technologies is that there are lots of different versions of them. And so if I learn one version with my employer, I don't necessarily have a marketable skill that I can take anywhere else. What tends to happen over time is industries standardize, skills get certified, so I can get a certificate that's gonna tell an employer that I've learned these skills on the job, I'm confident with this technology. You see this very well developed in the computer programming software development field. You know, where they have all sorts of specialties and all sorts of certifications. But we need to develop that more broadly. We need to encourage open standards, things like the Internet, which was the power of standardization is terrific in terms of building broad skills. A third area, I think, is employee mobility. If I learn a skill on a new technology with one employer, I want to be able to take it to another employer. I want to be free to do that. And there are two reasons for that. One is, with new technologies, a lot of the knowledge gets spread around by people going from one company to another. We see this most strongly in Silicon Valley, where job hopping is a very important part of the mix. People will switch from one company to another. They're bringing knowledge to their new employer. They're also, there's a second benefit, though, which is if I have a skill that is marketable that I can take to another employer, I have the strongest incentives to invest in acquiring new skills. So employee mobility is very important in that way also. Unfortunately, we've seen a number of movements in this country which have tended to restrict employee mobility. Employee mobility is down. People change occupations less. People change jobs less. You know, you hear all the time about the fluidity of the labor market today, but it's actually less. And we can point to some specific policies in some areas. For instance, many states have greatly expanded the power of employee non-compete agreements. We're seeing them being used now for the majority of technical personnel, which, you know, what it means in many states is if I work for a company and things don't go well and I leave, I may not be able to work in the industry for 2 years. And that can destroy a lot of incentives and destroy a lot of skills.
Now, we're almost out of time, but I just thought of something that's, you know, pretty interesting in line with this. Are you familiar with people who run companies that need highly skilled workers who actually create computer games that become very popular, and then they watch who plays these games and who's get really skilled at them, and then they go out and they get that person and they say, hey, I want you to come in and work for my genetic biotech firm because you're really skilled at this game, and what you're doing there can be replicated over here, and I need somebody who can do this, and I'll pay you a couple hundred thousand a year. Have you ever heard of this?
Yeah. The variety of their games, their contexts, where people compete to see who can come up with the best solution, and these are often tied in with hiring decisions. It becomes part of somebody's reputation. It works very well for things like computer programmers, software developers, because those are skills that are very well defined. It's a setting that's well defined. It hasn't proven so far to be something that can translate to a wide range of other sorts of occupations.
But there might be a lot of young people out there that don't even realize that they have this skill and wouldn't even pursue that if it weren't for these video games and so forth.
Yeah. It's also true. You know, you have people across the world working on things like open source software, and very often that can be useful. You know, they make contributions that are publicly known and publicly reviewed and essentially publicly ranked, and that can be an important entree to an employer because you see some cases where some very talented programmer gets recruited from God knows where in the world.
Now, we only have 1 minute for this. But, you know, my opinion is that the establishment in the public school system is a problem. And you only have a minute to either say, I totally disagree with you, or, you know, you might have something there, but I'm not willing to go into it with you.
I think we have entrenched bureaucracy in the public school.
Yeah, that's a very politically well-phrased statement.
There's some tremendous people in the public schools doing great things, but there are also some very clear problems.
Yes, I would agree. So how can people stay in touch with you? You have a blog or anything that they
I'm on Twitter, at James Bessen.
B-E-S-S-E-N.
Yes.
B-E-S-S-E-N. At James Bessen on Twitter. You have one parting word for us? We've got about 15, 20 seconds.
I guess my catchword is it's not scarce jobs, it's scarce skills.
Yeah, I would agree wholeheartedly. James, I really appreciate your time with us. And we're out of time now, Chris. This is Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.